We'll try to offer some intellectual sustenance while you continue to munch away at your lunches. Our panel today is about philanthropy and the arts. I think it's safe to say that more attention has been given to private philanthropy in America in the last 2 weeks than in the last 2 years, or maybe even the past 2 decades. There have been 4 magazine covers that I've seen passing through airports. There have been at least 5 or 6 hours on public television and C-SPAN devoted to philanthropy. I counted 6 different bylines in the New York Times of reporters writing in the business section, the front page, the arts section, all of it due to Warren Buffett's $10 million or 10 million share transfer of Berkshire Hathaway stock to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, primarily for global health. Well, this is your opportunity. If anyone here today would like to announce a gift of similar magnitude to the arts, this is the time, this is the venue. Just come on down, and we'll relinquish the microphones to you, and we might even help you think about how to structure it. In any event, the Buffett gift has been placed in context by the best reporters. They've talked about National Science Foundation funding. They've talked about NIH funding. They've talked about World Health Organization funding. Equally complex, I think, is our much smaller arts economy, the cultural ecosystem that supports the arts in the United States. And today what we've done is put together a panel that I think will illuminate the arts funding ecosystem and how the pieces all fit together. The arts ecosystem includes private philanthropy from corporations, from private foundations, from individuals. Our best assessment is that that's about $17 billion a year in recent years. That it's about $4.5 to $5 billion from private foundations, about $2 billion from corporations, and about $11 billion from individuals. Another important piece is the public sector's role. It comes from the federal government, state and local governments. We have something like 4,000 arts agencies at work at the state and local level. And again, I'm sure Dana may be able to correct this. There are something like 30 different agencies of the federal government with some arts funding. And then there's a forgotten piece. At least we don't think about it very much. But many of our nonprofit cultural institutions rely very heavily on earned income. Roughly half in the aggregate of the funding of our cultural economy is earned income from ticket sales and revenues. Well, today's panel, I think, can help us put all of this together. And I'm going to introduce them briefly. You've got more detailed biographies in the program. And then I'll have a question or two for each of them, and then we'll throw it open to the floor. What we have in this panel is really a picture of the entire funding ecosystem. Leonard Lauder is chairman of the S.D. Lauder Companies, and he's active on many boards. The University of Pennsylvania, his alma mater, is one board. He's on the Aspen board. And I think of greatest relevance today is his role as chairman of the Whitney Museum of American Art. We have Dana Gioia, a distinguished poet with 3 published volumes of poetry, a critic, a translator of poetry, and since 2003, the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. And we have Jennifer Goodale, Vice President for Contributions of the Altria Group. Her portfolio includes not only the arts, but Altria's other programs in the prevention of domestic violence, prevention of hunger, disaster relief, HIV/AIDS, and many more, including encouraging volunteerism and contributions by Altria's employees. And we have Alan Fletcher, a composer, studied at Juilliard and Princeton, with more than 70 works to his credit. He's taught at the New England Conservatory of Music. He's taught at Carnegie Mellon University. And he's president of the Aspen Music Festival and school. Well, I'd like to begin with the oldest piece of our funding ecosystem, to think about the role that private foundations, private individuals, private patronage plays in general. Private patronage is very old. Beethoven and Mozart had their complaints about it and strong opinions about it. It has remained more vigorous in the United States than anywhere else in the world. It has remained particularly vigorous in New York City. And I'd like to ask Leonard why private giving has played such an important role, such a continuing role in the support for cultural life in the United States, and what it is doing that public giving can't.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. By the way, I am two people today, myself and Evelyn Lauder, who I'm the designated hitter for Evelyn, so that I'll try to talk out of both sides of my mouth at the same time if I can. I, as the chairman of the Whitney Museum, am reminded of a story that during the Republic of Venice, when the Doge was elected and then he was inaugurated, he was rowed through the canals of Venice and he threw gold coins to the populace. I am the Doge of the Whitney Museum. And so why do we rely so heavily on private funding, especially in New York City? But I think this is the case in many museums around the country. Firstly, private funding is more risk-free than public funding. Do you remember the case of Rudy Giuliani taking after the Brooklyn Museum, where he felt that they had desecrated the Catholic religion, and he wanted to cancel the lease of the Brooklyn Museum and stop the check of their monthly check of $445,000, and the check bounced because he felt that that was either a desecration, or did he do it for political purpose? We don't know. Was the reaction of Jesse Helms, the late Jesse Helms, against the Robert Mapplethorpe show a reaction because he was truly offended, or was this a combination of offense and a political reaction? Because we have to remember one thing, that although many people here in the audience consider themselves moderates or liberals, this is basically a very, very conservative nation, and that there is just a thin veneer of liberalism or moderation over the arts, over the visual arts, and over other arts. I grew up during a period when Sons and Lovers was forbidden in the United States. The works of Henry Miller were forbidden in the United States. Some of you are old enough to remember the phrase banned in Boston. The movie La Ronde from 1953 could not come to the United States. So that this is a deeply conservative nation. So that the only way that you can open your doors and open your windows to visual artists' expressions, and perhaps even expressions of protest, is not to seek government funding, but to seek private funding. And somewhere between government funding on one hand and private funding on the other hand stands corporate funding, and the corporations have their own ambitions and their own problems. And we have had our own situations over the years. We had a museum branch in Stamford, Connecticut, which was run by Champion, which was in the Champion, the paper building. When I was out here in Aspen several years ago, I got a call from the deputy director of the Whitney Museum that the head of Champion wanted to have a particular show that was on removed instantly and immediately. And I said, why? And the answer was, there are too many penises in the show. So that don't think that corporate funding of the arts is a benign source of funding, that we have to look more and more to private philanthropy, because private philanthropy indeed is the one independent area that we can feel safest with in allowing the free expression of the artists that we show.
So, thank you. Dana, public sector support has historically been problematic. Most of us know, though few of us actually recall, the New Deal experiments in federal funding that were so unceremoniously killed after less than a decade. We've had cultural skirmishes from the very beginning of NEA, breaking out into cultural wars. And I think rather successfully in the past 8 years or so, we've had a kind of cultural truce. I wonder if that means that we have finally found a proper federal role in supporting culture. And if we have, how does that federal role fit into the cultural economy in relationship to private support?
Yeah, I don't think in general the role of the federal government in the arts is well understood, even in the United States, in a general sense, although individuals understand how it works in their particular areas. The biggest supporter of every art form, from the safest to the most controversial in the United States, is the federal government. It was done somewhat unintentionally through the tax deduction. If you want to write a check for religious art, you want to write a check for transgressive art, the federal government in the old days used to go halvesies. Now it pays about a quarter of that. That system is, in a very American way, rather brilliant, because it decentralizes, depoliticizes, localizes, and personalizes most of the cultural investment in the United States. And it allows corporations, foundations, individuals, in a sense, to be more generous. So that is the envy of Europe. They wish that they had that, because they are facing a kind of crisis of public arts funding. Now, in addition to this, the U.S. subsidizes arts both directly and indirectly, through many organizations and also through earmarks. I would guess more money is given to American cultural institutions through earmarks than through all of the direct appropriations for the cultural agencies combined, because they tend to be large. As part of a highway bill, six museums will get $2 million a year. It doesn't go through any of the cultural agencies. So I think I wanted to put that as background. I do think, what I've tried to do, I can't speak for chairman before me, but what I've tried to do with the endowment is to, in some ways, largely ignore the controversies of the past and to instead try to create a positive model of what productive federal investment in arts and arts education should be, which is to say that it's not about being controversial or not being controversial. It's about supporting excellence and making that excellence as broadly available in the United States as possible. And by doing that, and by doing that, I think preemptively, we've been able to change the public conversation about arts funding in the U.S. The federal budgets have been raised. The state budgets, have sort of followed suit. So I do think that actually we are in a relatively good phase. I mean, during the last budget hearings in Congress, not one person spoke against the National Endowment for the Arts. That's the first time in decades that's happened. We had a bipartisan voice vote that they didn't even bother to count because they knew that we had a strong bipartisan majority. And I do think that we've done it not by sort of saying, oh, we're going to be safe, oh, we're going to be bold. We've done it by doing things of I think, fairly widely acknowledged excellence and by being ambitiously democratic and bringing them to areas of the country that wouldn't normally get them. And I can give you examples, but at least in principle, that's what we're trying to do. And so what I'm trying to do is to go back to the New Deal, go back to the federal arts programs of the 30s, which I think are a model of kind of democratic involvement in terms of arts, and make them viable for the United States today.
Thank you. Jennifer, the corporate funding for the arts, indeed corporate philanthropy generally, is the youngest and newest piece of the puzzle. I think most people probably know that corporate philanthropy is really only about 50 years old in the United States. It's very hard for us to measure it. And for some, it's particularly hard, I think, for us to understand it in philanthropic terms, because so much of it seems to be about marketing, about branding, about corporate image making. And I wonder if you could give us a better sense of what some of the deeper motivations of corporate funding in the arts in particular really is.
I think it's actually a very challenging time for corporate funding for the arts. And I think I see, and I think you all hear and read in the media, there's this great trend of increase in funding in corporate philanthropy. And every year it's more and more companies are coming into the field. Well, that could be true, but I'm telling you that those companies are not giving to the arts. And if they are giving to the arts, it is usually for a marketing program. It is maybe a lot of money for 1 or 2 years, but this consistent level of a general operating support across the board is just not happening. There are a few companies, of course, like a UBS or I think of Target that maybe are doing something, but it's just not, we as in the corporate world are not going to be able to step up and fund the arts. And it drives me crazy. It drives my peers crazy who love the arts, because we know how important the arts are to our society. And the future of funding is really, I believe, in individual philanthropy. Because what's happening is, while many businesses, the expectations of our society are that businesses should give back. We all know that. Every Fortune 500 company does give back in some way, shape, or form. And what they're looking for in their philanthropy, typically, is funding programs that impact their bottom line, that make sense to their business. Now, something like the arts, it's a hard sell. Of course, I would say that the arts are about creativity. They're about innovation. And I love that quote that Ezra Pound said, that artists are the antenna of the race. And I strongly, strongly believe that that's what the arts are all about. And that's why Altria got into the arts almost 50 years ago, because we had chairman and leadership who believed in creativity, who understood the power of the arts and how it inspired. And a quick little anecdote, about 1965, actually, George Weissman, who's a wonderful man, and Joe Coleman, they actually commissioned a few artists, names like Andy Warhol and James Rosenquist, Jim Dine, to do a few things that they would put together and tour around the country, particularly to the plants where we had offices and factories, etc. Well, very few, no museums wanted to take it on. This was a weird thing. Why would a company? There was a lot of suspicion. Finally, the AFA did agree to show it in their space in New York originally. Reviews were terrible. What is this junk? How can a company fund anything like this? It was awful. Well, lo and behold, of course, 10 years later or so, we have these great names. But it was a risk. And it started Altria on a trend to understand the value of the arts and how important it is for our culture, for our community, for our employees, and just for thinking innovatively. So that's our story.
Thank you. Alan, foundations and individual patrons have certainly played a role in the institutions you've been a part of. Many people probably don't know that the single largest gift to music in the United States, and I suspect this would still hold true, was what was then about $15 to $17 million that Augustus Juilliard gave in 1919 to create the Juilliard Music Foundation, which after a couple of years became the Juilliard School. There was a wonderful period of creativity, in fact. Mary Curtis Bach giving her $12 million to the Curtis Institute, George Eastman giving about $20 million by the 1930s for Eastman. Philanthropists have certainly supported the training of young composers, musicians, and artists of all sorts. You're seeing these young artists come into the early phases of their careers. And I wonder if you could give us a sense of where philanthropy or where the public sector might somehow be missing some of the connections or might be doing more to help individual artists.
Okay, let me start. I'm going to answer by indirection, just so you are ready for that. And I do want to start by saying that Altria has been just a beacon in all of the arts over that 50-year period. It's exceptional, and it is exceptional in every sense of the word for what Altria has accomplished. And then I want to throw about a 20-year-old albatross to Dana, and he will answer in a few minutes, that I do think that the NEA's grants to individual artists, that program was a fantastic program and really an essential one, and I very much regret its disappearance. And I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes and maybe explain both why it is important, but also why it was always a very tiny part of the life of the artist in America, and it was never intended to be more than a very small program. What we need to concentrate on, I think, is not that top of the pyramid, because the most intense artistic activity anywhere will generally always find a funder. And so I'm much more concerned with the grassroots and the base of the pyramid. There's very striking numbers that show that, and Dana can talk to this directly, that there's an extremely direct correlation between having studied an instrument as a young person and becoming a subscriber to a symphony or an opera later in life. That is, anyone can go into a store and buy a CD, but the activity of actively supporting a musical organization has a huge correlation to some kind of personal musical experience as a child, and therefore we should be extremely concerned with fostering music in the schools. Speaking now, because this was Jim's question, about the young composer coming out of schools. We have more and more composers being graduated from our schools of music in the U.S. They are of higher and higher quality every year. I've been seeing this for 25 years. And what I say to those young people is the most important thing would not be to aspire to be one of 5 or 10 people getting an NEA individual artist grant. Because if that's what they are waiting for, they're going to have a long wait. But the most important thing is to attach oneself to the community, whether it's a small town or a city, but to attach oneself to the life of a community and to make new music part of the vitality of the art scene in that life. So get a commission from Nashua Symphony in New Hampshire. Get a commission from Northern Indiana Symphony. Go to La Jolla and just get to know those people. That this is the way to get started. So what would the role of government be in that? I'm not so sure. It's certainly a kind of seeding role, but it's much more important that the individual appear in the community and stimulate the community to make that support. I do want to respond to some themes that we've already heard here. I often find people who wish they could experience in the U.S. the level of support and the kind of support that one finds routinely in the United Kingdom or in France or in Germany. But the reality is that Europe is coming to us to see how our arts community is supported and not vice versa. And just last week, a festival from Switzerland, the Verbier Festival, one of the most important festivals of music in Europe, and lavishly supported up till now by UBS, I might add, they came to us, to Aspen, to ask very probing and very intense questions about how we organize philanthropy, how we organize our approach to individuals, to foundations, the structures of our fundraising operation. Just another fact, this is not in any way contradictory to what Jim said, because the larger trend is different. But at the music festival in Aspen, almost 70% of our operating fund comes through philanthropy, through the combination of a draw off our endowment, which was given by individuals, and the annual fund. So we're hugely dependent on the generosity of our patrons. In any case, I wanted to leave with one thought. The young composers I see this summer in Aspen, in our most elite program, our master class, truly understand that it is their responsibility to find their own career. And whereas 25 years ago, when I was in their position, I had some glimmering of that and a mixture of dread and resentment at the fact that I would need to find my own way and my own funding and my own career, these young people are ready for it. And they've had a lot of good training in the fact that they must go to the community and represent themselves to the communities that will support them in the arts.
Thanks. Well, I think you can see that this cultural ecosystem has different streams all flowing together. The question that comes to mind, and I think it's implicit in what each of you have said, is that there may be a need for partnerships, that there's always a need for partnerships, but that there may be some difficulties in creating public-private or even private foundations working with corporate foundations, putting these partnerships together. I wonder if I could ask each of you to suggest what is the greatest difficulty you see in building a relationship with another funding source, and if there are things that you'd like them to be doing that you can't, that you feel that they can. Leonard?
Well, that's a tough question. Look, everyone has an agenda. And the real challenge is how do you, since we all need money and we're all desperate for money, how do you meet their needs? In New York City, corporate support of the arts, with the exception of Altria, is not because they believe in the arts, but they want to use the museum facilities to entertain customers. And this may be a surprise to you. However, a key part of the budget going forward for the Museum of Modern Art is corporate entertaining. We've had to, with the Whitney, create a whole department of people who feed people. And so we'll say, fine, you want to use our facilities, this great place, you have to do this, you have to do that. So that with the exception of Altria, with the exception of Target, and Target, by the way, is an outgrowth of the Dayton family in Minneapolis that gave 5% a year away of from their bottom line every year to the arts. Regardless of whether it was a good year or a bad year, it was 5%. These are people who firmly believe in the arts. Most other people have an agenda, and how do you match their agenda needs with what you have to offer? that's one of the things that I do, and that also creates problems because 1 year I was able to get $8 million from one corporation, which was fabulous. The next year, the chairman got fired. And so how do you close the gap?
Dana, I know you've worked with the private sector in many ways.
What I would actually is I'd answer your question by saying I think there's an ease of partnership. Now, that may be the federal government speaking, but every year the NEA gives 2,000 grants across the United States and U.S. jurisdictions. Every one of those grants is a partnership, and usually a very complicated partnership. For example, our Shakespeare program at this point has had about 3,000 partners, institutional partners, making it happen. And I think that, you know, now this may be the role, really, of the federal government is to give small catalytic grants and to help construct partnerships that take maybe not so much in New York City, which is an entity in and of itself, but takes an Albuquerque or takes a Topeka or takes a Fort Lauderdale and enables them to create a partnership much more extensive than they could ever really do locally. What the NEA grant does is say that a panel of experts summoned in Washington, looking at hundreds of grant applications, has said this is one of the best, and the federal government is going to give a grant. It also says, and this is interesting, now a lot of times I'll say, if we give a grant, unlike most other federal grants, you have to match an NEA grant. And let's say Michael York, who is a great actor and great patron of the arts there, brings a project to us, and we give him a grant for a Shakespeare education project. And I'll say, Michael, do you want a 1-to-1 match? Michael will say, no, I want a 3-to-1. Because that way he can knock on 3 different doors and say, well, we're going to lose the federal money, Leonard, unless you write a check. And so what we've discovered is that every dollar that we have tends to generate 8 additional dollars in terms of funding. Mm-hmm. So there's this pyramiding ability. So we give the project legitimacy, we provide an urgency of matches, and we create, as it were, the mechanism for a partnership to be developed. So I think that actually everybody at every institution, I mean, no one pretty much has a single source of funding anymore. So everybody has to do partnerships, and everybody's getting pretty good at it. And that's what the Europeans desperately want to learn from us, because they've largely had one partner, the central funding, maybe the municipality funding, but it's all been public funding. And they don't know how to put together these partnerships of 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 people. How many people did it take to build the new wing and the remodeling of MoMA? Tens of thousands, probably.
Jennifer, you want to...
Yeah, I think partnerships are critical, and actually I agree with you that I've seen a trend of an ease in partnerships in terms of funding sources. We used to, I think, be much more... we want to have the sole sponsorship, as did other companies, and now we're understanding that we have to share, and it actually works much better because you're bringing in new companies into the field. However, I do think there are two tiers here, because there's when you have a successful product or a successful company like an Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater or a Whitney or a MoMA, companies want to be part of that. So that there's money out there. When you talk about the emerging artists, the smaller companies who are coming up or being more risky and more experimental, it's tougher. And so how do you ensure that these companies and artists can be sustained and be given the support they need? I also think that the partnership with the government is critical. I think the NEA provides us as reviewers of grants, that imprimatur that this is a quality program, this is excellence. Because we know the NEA is made up of people, of peers, of experts in the field, and they offer an objective point of view. Unlike other foundations or funders who might have an ulterior motive to be part of that particular program or organization. So I think there's partnerships all around, and foundations like the Ford or the Rockefeller or the Robert Sterling Clark, we're constantly, we're often sitting down together now talking about how can we help the arts? How can we encourage and educate business people about the value of the arts? And it's not easy. And as a little anecdote, because I have to go back to this because I'm so passionate about it, the conference board, I think many of you may know, there's a contributions council of the conference board, and about 75 or 100 people like me sit on that from all companies, Fortune 500 companies. And when we have a meeting 3 times a year, when we want to talk about the agenda, what's on the agenda for the next one, we created ourselves. Well, when a couple of us, like Time Warner, who's a great supporter of the arts also, and I, we said we'd love to have a 3-day session on the arts. I swear to God, about 85% of people in that room said, no way. There is no way I can spend the time on that. If I go back to my boss and say I want to fund the arts, he'd kick me out. I mean, so we pushed and we screamed, and we got one day on the agenda. But still, I mean, that's our reality of corporate funding. So we're trying, though, and I think challenge grants are critical.
So we're really seeing that much of the important corporate philanthropy is in effect personal philanthropy because it's an individual or a family that are directing it. And I do want to say that we at Aspen Music have had a great partnership with the National Endowment on our American Academy of Conducting. And I do think that the recognition from the National Endowment that this was a great program to start was critical to our attracting a major amount, and which was in something like a 3-to-4-to-1 proportion, a major amount of individual and family foundation support for that program, which is now fully funded as a result. There's a new study out of Yale and University of Chicago about the power of the matching grant, and which makes it quite explicit that people are something like 80% more likely to give, period, and then 60% more likely to make a larger gift than they would have otherwise made if there is a match. And curiously, it doesn't even matter if it's 1-to-1, 2-to-1, or 3-to-1. But I think it is what we're hearing here. It's the sense of confidence that someone else has put a seal of approval on this project, because everything we do in the arts is a step into the unknown. That's the nature of what we do. And we cannot be certain, just in the easy case of music, we can't be certain with a 17-year-old whether this is the long of the future or not. And so we have to make major investments, and particularly when it's in creative work.
Yeah. Well, all of us up here are concerned about audiences in different ways. And I think what we'd like to do now is to turn to you as this audience, and to see whether you have questions. Are there microphones, or are you simply going to have to project?
There's one over there.
There's a microphone over here and a question over near the microphone.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the panel. We had a panel earlier today on global healthcare, and the subject of microgrants came up. I'm wondering if, given that many of the raw tools of creation and distribution of artistic product are coming down in price, whether there's a role for microfunding and microgrants in the arts, for example, in helping young composers do very small performances that can be distributed through MP3 means, things like that. Has that come up as part of the public conversation, microfunding in the arts?
I think I could deflect that to Alan to talk about the role of small grants. I could also say something about a wonderful initiative in New York that I've been involved in called the Creative Capital Foundation, where grants of 5,000 to individual artists at the right stage in their career can make an enormous difference. Alan?
Yes. So let me just say absolutely yes. And I think a tremendous impact can be made. It goes back to that community level. You want the grant to be available to people in a very particular time and place who know what they're doing and why, and who will support a kind of emerging artist in a way that a large corporation simply cannot do. They cannot know everything that's happening and sift through. But if you're in Des Moines, you can. You can know who is there and why they're there. But Creative Capital is a sensational program, so we should hear about that.
Sure. Do you want to hear a little about it? Creative Capital was an initiative that several of us, I'll declare, I was on the founding board and one of the founders of it. When NEA moved away from individual artist grants, about 10 foundations in New York came together with the notion that if we could give grants at the right stage, modest grants, we could engage artists in thinking long-term about their careers. And we could also encourage them to do what artists have done for a long time, and that is to find some way of giving back to others. And one of the unique things about the Creative Capital Grant is that if an artist really succeeds, whether it's the CD sales or some intellectual property right, there's an expectation, and we call it Creative Capital for this reason, that they will somehow give back and money will be regenerated. The Andy Warhol Foundation has been the principal donor behind it, contributing something on the order of $10 million or so. If there were a Warren Buffett out there, we'd like to see more. Another question.
Okay, I may be one of the few people in the room that's a recipient of grants rather than a giver, and a current NEA recipient. It's a question with an anecdote. I'm currently an NEA recipient for a project we're doing on improving the living conditions of slum dwellers. It seems very bizarre, but as an architect and working in the architecture and design arts, looking for federal money, they say go to the NEA because that's where you lie. The other anecdote is that we were doing an exhibit on some work we did developing mobile AIDS clinics, and it was funded by the State Department. And so we're in a realm where we don't know where we lie. So should we spend our time looking for federal funding, or should we just look for corporate and individual funding?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I think that you're talking about the American dilemma, which is that if you're an artist in America or you're, you know, involved in the nonprofit sector, you're going to be looking everywhere. And I also would offer this as an example of, I think, a misunderstanding of in a sense that we have gotten rid of certain categories of individual grants. But the NEA is still sponsoring enormous amounts of new work. I'll give you an example. We do not have a single individual grant in drama. We got rid of, I think, the 12 that we did every year. Last year, 135 new plays were premiered, funded by the NEA. And the way that we do this now is we go to an Aspen Music Festival, we go to a La Jolla Playhouse, and they apply to us, you know, the project of creating a new play, a new musical, a new design, a new architectural model, and we co-fund it with them. And what we effectively do is to take the decision about, you know, the artistic creation away from a federal committee and bring it to the actual performing arts group. Now, I think this has two really big advantages which are not really understood. And, you know, and I feel that somehow, you know, you're beating a dead horse and talking about the individual grants because of this. First of all, let's say we gave a grant to a composer to do a new opera. And there are specific cases of this I can point, where you'll have a superb composer spend years working on an opera that is then never put on. And so you have, in a sense, funded creativity, but you haven't, in a sense, completed the mission. If we give a $25,000 grant, let's say that we were going to give this to an opera company rather than the composer, with a 3-to-1 match, they commission the opera. The composer gets $25,000. It is now performed. The opera company has the kind of developmental experience of creating a new work, the conductors, the scenic designers, the directors, the singers creating new parts, and then the audience has the experience of engaging a new work. What you've done, in a funny way, is with the same money through pyramiding, you know, through matches, has fostered creativity, but has also fostered institutional development and audience development in a much more efficient way. And we do this, you know, across the arts. And I think it's actually a much more cost-effective way of achieving the same creative ends, but also brings an institutional development issue into it.
So I don't want to derail in that Dana and I have profound agreement, except on that. First, just a quick anecdote is that in my career in conservatories and now at the Aspen Music Festival, I've gotten grants from the first ever portfolio from the Department of Education of grants for arts education. That was just a few years ago, the first ever such portfolio. And those were generous grants, and I was able to bring one of them to my conservatory. We've had the Academy of Conducting, the NEA grant. By far, the largest amount of money I've gotten from the government or seen come from the government was an earmark in a Department of the Interior bill. Thank you, Teddy Kennedy. And so that, in effect, goes back to that private philanthropy. If you have the connections to a political figure or have the kind of political figure in your state who can do that, then you're lucky. So I think you should check out your senators and representatives. And
yeah, there is, I mean, to build on this, there is one of the ironies of working in Washington is to have senators or congressmen who vote against the NEA budget, but then basically, you know, give a $2 million grant to a cultural institution in their district, which is what a politician should do, is look after their own. But it is, in a sense that, you know, that so much of it's off the books. Mm-hmm. That's why no one in the world today knows how much money the federal government invests in the arts, because some of it's trackable and some of it isn't. But it is a huge amount of money, both directly in terms of the institutions and indirectly through the tax deduction.
So I do want to say that the individual artist grants that I liked were peer-reviewed, and they were without a project end in sight. So they were not to write an opera. They were just to do whatever you feel like doing at that time. And there is a basic research value in that, which is different from saying we want more operas on the stage. Of course we do. But those grants were more aimed at just a basic support for the idea of the artist in the society.
And just maybe to add on that, we're seeing a trend towards a greater focus on measurement and results. And I think that can be very harmful to the artist, because you have to allow failure. And so that's another element in the corporate world. You have to try to explain and understand to those around you.
But doesn't that go back to the essential original idea of patronage? That when the king supported Brahms, he didn't say, "Now, write me a 5-page proposal, please, and let's hear it, and then I'll see whether I want to do it." And my wife Evelyn is very fond of saying how would you imagine that Michelangelo had gone and had to prepare a long proposal as to exactly where the fingers were going to match? Patronage is patronage. To say, okay, here's an artist, we need to support him, period. And I think that when you try to put some kind of a success factor or an end result attached to patronage, it's no longer patronage, it's something else. I'm not saying it's bad, but it's not patronage.
Yeah, but historically, most private and public patronage has been to build a statue of David here. I mean, and honest to God, Michelangelo did not want to paint, you know, he wanted to do the tomb of Julius II, which was going to be the new tomb of Halicarnassus. And they said, well, no, you just paint on the ceiling here. And they basically gave him the topics, you know. So, yeah. I mean, so, you know, sometimes, I mean, I think the real secret of patronage is to find the right art, to find the Michelangelo, to find the Brahms. And one of the ironies of history is that evil popes, merciless bandit kings, syphilitic monarchs have generally impeccable taste in art. Committees of experts do not. You know, I say this as a Catholic, you know, give me another Julius II. You know, great soldier, great arts patron, not a terribly good pope. You know, but, you know, he did get St. Peter started. He did, you know, remodel the Sistine Chapel. And God bless him, you know.
But David was placed in the Signoria by a peer review panel.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we have time for one more question.
My question is for Jennifer.
Hold on. Wait.
Pretty loud.
Okay, Jen.
Thank you. My question is for Jennifer, actually. I work for an organization which is essentially United Nations for all the Native American tribal governments in the United States. And as you can imagine, arts and culture and its preservation are extraordinarily important to our communities, and we try and invest in them as much as we can. But from a business perspective, in many of our communities where we have 80% unemployment rates, it's very much about economic development as well for our communities. And I was wondering if that was something that the larger corporate community thought about as well in its arts investment.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's a critical part to much of our funding. I mean, arts as a catalyst for economic development. So if there are programs or projects specifically in dance that, or the visual arts that you can create or that you're doing and submit to Altria, you know, I'm putting it out there, but no one else. absolutely, because, I mean, that's the age-old argument. Arts is an economic tool for economic development, and the statistics are out there, and we rant and we rave about them. I don't think they go on deaf ears most of the time, but of course that's critical, and especially for the Native American community.
If I can just inject something here, I have two jobs, one of which is the chairman of the Whitney Museum, the other of which is I'm the chairman of a public corporation. And we were able to give much more money to the arts and other things when we were a privately held company. Today,
If we miss our numbers, not our numbers, the numbers of the analysts, by one penny a share, they will knock the value of our stock down by 20 to 30% and take billions of dollars off of market value. That's why things that you just have brought up that are so important, one says, well, maybe we should or maybe we shouldn't. Let's leave that to the federal government, or let's leave that to the Rockefeller Foundation or someone else like that. So that many of these things which are quite worthy, sadly, can't be dealt with as much as we would like to.
Mm-hmm. We're approaching 1 o'clock. I think sometimes our discussions of funding, of the utility of the arts, pull the discussion down a bit, and we end on a note that may not let us think really about what the arts are about. And in thinking about this panel, and actually hearing the first part of the panel on the role of arts in and culture in a democracy, I recalled a quote from John F. Kennedy, a month before he died, before the creation of NEA, that reminds us a bit of the role of the individual artists and of what the arts have to do with democracy. And he said, "Art is not a form of propaganda. It's a form of truth. In a free society, art is not a weapon, and it does not belong to the sphere of polemics and ideology. Artists are not engineers of the soul. It may be different elsewhere, but in a democratic society, the highest duty of the writer, the composer, the artist, is to remain true to himself and let the chips fall where they may." Let's thank our panel, and thank you all for being
James,
here.
James, can I make an announcement? As an example of federal largesse, I would like to offer you on your way out, over. I've been told they're over by the Fiji waters. There's some CDs of radio shows for a huge new program the NEA has created called The Big Read, which is a way of creating civic reading of great American novels. There's CDs. Please take both of them. And you'll thank me next time you're caught in traffic and you slip one into your car.
Thank you.